If you'd like to open your Bibles to Acts chapter 23, that's where I'll be studying from this evening. Once again, we have guests in our audience, and we thank you for being here. There's some special folks here tonight. For me, that are as close to family as family can be without being that. One of the wives of my elders is present with her daughter and son-in-law. They daughter and son-in-law live in Bull Verde, and the mother is down helping the daughter get her classroom ready to go, and so I'm glad to have Jackie and Paige in court here with us tonight. They mean the world to me. And thankful for all the guests that we have. I want to take just a moment to express my great appreciation to this church and to your eldership as your representatives to invite me to come and be part of your church family this week. I've enjoyed the time with you. You have been so very receptive. You've been so very encouraging. You've listened so well, and you've helped keep me going through the week. When I corresponded with Tim about these lessons, I expressed some apprehension about having a whole week on parenting. I thought maybe it might be a little overkill, and so what I tried to do was to make each lesson have its own legs and yet keep a thread going through. And you have enabled me to keep that fresh, and I appreciate that very much. And I hope that they have been beneficial to you. As I said Sunday morning, I don't know anything about raising kids. I had two, and they're the byproduct of the DNA of myself and my wife. I've just tried to bring something to you from God's Word that will hopefully help, because that is an objective source that we can trust. Along the way, I made a lot of mistakes. I'd like to have a couple mulligans over again, but that's the way it is. You do the best you can at the time you have. And you look back after it's over and you say, well, I wish I'd have handled that differently. But you did the best you could. And that's all we can do while we're doing it. To the young people who have been here and listened, I thank you so much. I appreciate it. To the young mothers who brought your young babies and struggled with them as each assembly progressed, thank you so much for being here. And I have been greatly encouraged by being with you. And I reciprocate what Terry has said. It's been a joy to be with Terry and Dee. We got started off Saturday night together, and we did go back a ways, as Terry suggested. And I told my wife earlier this week, if you can't get along with Terry Starling, you just can't get along with anybody. He and my cousin George Slover are of the same cloth. If you can't get along with either one of those guys, then you're just not going to get along with anybody. Because Terry has been easy to get along with and very encouraging along the way. I enjoy doing this work. I really do. I enjoy preaching. I enjoy going to preach. I enjoy being with people like this. I enjoy getting to know people. But there's one aspect of this that is a challenge to me, and always has been, and that is that the girl that is the apple of my eye is back home. And in the morning, Lord willing, I'll wake up early and make my way back to the Dallas area and hopefully get to see her by mid-morning at least. That is, if me and the pickup make it that far. Thank you so much for being here and for the opportunity to share these things with you. I want to close the series tonight by talking about an individual that I don't know that I've paid a lot of attention to. Maybe you have. I'm not going to suggest that you've overlooked him, but I know for a long time I overlooked Paul's nephew, except for just the passing study that goes through the narrative of the book of Acts. But as I said in the beginning, these lessons grew out of a class that in a quarter I did at home, and this was one of the lessons that I discovered, and it meant a lot to me at the time that I taught it in the class with the young families that were there. And so I wanted to implement it this week, and I wanted to use it as the closing lesson to hopefully kind of put the cherry on top of the ice cream cone of the meeting tonight with this lesson. Because really everything we've talked about this week comes down to some things we're going to mention in this lesson. But let's begin reading in Acts chapter 23 and verse 11. But the following night the Lord stood by him and said, be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness of me at Rome. And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a great oath that we will eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Now you therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him. But we are ready to kill him before he comes near. So when Paul's sister's son heard of the ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called out one of the centurions to him and said, "Take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Then the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked privately, "What is it you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council together, as though you were going to inquire more fully about him. But do not yield to them. More than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." So the commander let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you have revealed these things to me." And he called for the two centurions, saying, "Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen, and go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night, and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor." He wrote a letter in the following manner: "Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council, and I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but they had nothing to charge against him deserving of death or chains. And when it was told that to me the Jews lie in wait for him, for that man, I sent immediately to you, and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell." And the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul. They brought him by night unto Praetorius, and the next day they left their horsemen to go with him and return to the barracks. And when they came to Caesarea and had delivered the letter to the governor and also presented Paul, the governor read it and asked what province he was from. And when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear you when your accusers also have come." And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's Praetorium. Several years ago, there was an experiment that a counselor took with her students. There were several classes that had convened. And in each class, there were 10 students. 9 of the students had been told what to say. That meant there was one that had not been informed of the ruse. The counselor had on the board 2 different lines. One line was longer than the other. And so, when the children were in the room, the counselor asked the class, pointing to the lines, first pointing to the shortest line, then the longest line, asking the class, "How many think this line, which pointing at the shortest, is the longest?" The 9 kids raised their hands. The one child that was not in on the ruse was sitting there, and everybody else had raised their hands. 75% of the time, the 10th child would raise their hand to join the 10. 75% of the time. Now, that may sound like, we get that. I mean, come on, we know the difference between short and long. We get that. But the test reveals something significant. And that is, we don't like to be isolated and we don't like to stand out. We like to blend in. We like to fit in. We don't want to be isolated and to be different from those with whom we are surrounded, especially if they are our peers, is almost next to death for the person that stands out. And 75% of the time, the 10th child would raise their hand. Our challenge as parents, and everything that we've talked about, is to help our children understand that it's okay for them to be distinctive. It's okay for them to be distinctive. It's okay for them to be their own individual. It's okay for them to be their own person. It's okay for them to have confidence in their own person and who they are. We want to raise our children to be children who have a fundamental respect for God and a fundamental respect for themselves and a fundamental respect for others, because they've learned their place in the families of others. They've learned what it means to honor and what is feel and what it is to feel and what it means to do right because it's right. And all it simply says is we try to be distinctive. Distinctive doesn't mean you have to be a nerd. Distinctive doesn't mean you have to wear different clothes necessarily, different clothes than others. That is oddball kind of clothes that make you stand out. Doesn't mean you have to cut your hair a particular way different than everybody else. Doesn't mean you have to be a weirdo. But it just means that when it's time to stand up, you stand up. And that makes you distinctive from everybody else. When you think about Paul's nephew, there were a couple of things that Paul's nephew faced here. First of all, there was fear that he had to overcome. If the Jews find out, remember the commander said, don't tell anyone what you've told me? If the Jews find out about what Paul's nephew has done, he's going to join Paul in being put to death. In fact, he may not make it as far as Paul. And then second, he has to go to Paul in a Roman prison, which was on the northwestern side of the city, which was where the Roman soldiers also housed themselves, which also housed the Praetorian Guard, which also was the guard that rotated guarding Paul. These were the elites of the elites among the guards. And he had to then therefore go to Paul in prison and risk himself being seen with Paul, and having been seen with Paul, also be cast into prison as well. So there were some challenges that this young man faced. It wasn't like this was going to be just like sliding on ice here and everything's going to be smooth for him. He's going to face some obstacles that are here that enable him to be the young man that stands out. And then also, doubtless, there are some of his peers that could have found out. We're not necessarily told how Paul's nephew learned about this. Paul's nephew is kind of, as it were, sitting in the corner listening to some things being said. Or maybe there are some peers that tell him about the plan that's being crafted here. But he also faces his own peers when he himself is the one that's going to go tell. So he has to deal with those things. And I would suggest those are not unlike things that we can put in our lives today. The fear of being distinctive and the fear of facing our peers in doing that, and the fears of having to stand up against everybody else, and we're the only one that's standing. We're the only one of 10 people not raising our hand, because we know the line they say is longest is the shortest. We know that. And we're going to stick by what we see and what we know. I want you to see a few qualities that this young man had. This young man had some decisiveness about him. I want you to see that when we begin reading in verse 15. Now, therefore, together with the council, they say, suggest the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow, as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we're ready to kill him. So when Paul's sister's son heard of their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the commander and said, Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you. He made a decision. He was decisive. He made a decision to go to talk to Uncle Paul and to tell Uncle Paul what he had heard. And then he had to follow through that decision with following the instruction that Uncle Paul gave to him. He was a decisive young man, but he also was persuasive. Think about it. He's going to this Roman commander, and he's going to stand before this Roman commander. Here's this young man, this young man that's come from the jail cell of Uncle Paul, and he's standing before the commander, and the commander says, what do you want to tell me? And notice the young man says, the Jews have agreed to ask to bring Paul down to council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire more fully about him. And then this young man convinces by his persuasion, convinces this commander that this is going to take place, and the commander sends 470 of his troops to accompany one man. That kind of reminds me of a scene in the life of Jesus. Whenever you remember in John chapter 18, when the Roman soldiers are coming to get Jesus, there are about 600 of them that come to get him. And Jesus is standing there, and Jesus says, "Who are you looking for?" And he says, "Jesus of Nazareth," and they all fall backwards. Wouldn't you like to have been the fly on the wall to see that? They pick themselves up, and he says, "Who are you looking for?" Jesus said, they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said, "Well, I told you I'm right here." 600 soldiers for one man? They must have thought this fellow was bad. And now you've got 470 soldiers going to protect Paul because you've got 40 men that have avowed, to take his life. And this Roman commander is going to make sure he doesn't lose a prisoner. But then I want you to see the confidence of this young man. Notice what he says in verse 21. After he instructs him relative to what the plan is, notice, the young man doesn't say, "I would like for you to think about this. You know, you've got trouble brewing at your door. I'd like for you to consider, sleep on this if you will. I'd like for you to think about this." No, he says, "Do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who have bound themselves by an oath that they will neither eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they're ready, waiting for the promise from you. Do not yield to him." This young man speaks with a great deal of confidence. And really, that's what we want to develop in our young people. We want to develop in our young people the ability to make decisions. Decisions because they are right. We want to develop in our young people the ability to be persuasive as they stand up for what is right when they have made those decisions. And we want them to have great confidence in the decisions that they have made. We want to have confidence that what they've done is bringing honor to God and honor to their parents, and that they're doing it because it's a right thing to do, and to be confident in that. I'll tell you, that's hard. That's hard to help our young people accomplish. It is not to my credit, and I don't say this to ask for Purple Heart at all. It is to my shame, I will admit. This young man did not describe me when I was a young man. When I was a young man, I was not decisive. I was not the young man that was persuasive, and I had no confidence. And standing up to somebody was not even a part of what my thinking was, because I wanted to fit in. I wanted to fit in. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them I still haven't gotten over. I was rather small of size. And being small, what that meant was I didn't fit in with the fellows that were bigger that played football and started on the baseball team. I was on the baseball team, but I sat the bench for 3 years. Because the coach always said there was somebody bigger. When I was in college, I had a farm power machinery class. And by this time, I had begun to change. And my professor told me, "You won't make an A in my class. You'll be lucky if you pass, because you're too small." Well, at that time, I'd begun to gain some confidence. And guess what grade I made in his class? I made an A in that class. The other thing that was a puzzlement to me and a botherment to me was my dad's a gospel preacher. And I always grew up being called a PK. And as one man said, one boy said to his father, "My father's a pilot, I can fly anywhere I want." Another boy said, "My father's a doctor, I can get sick anytime I want." Next one boy said, "My dad's a preacher, I can sin anytime I want." Well, and moving every 3 to 4 years did not help establish a foundation. Now, none of that's right. I'm not excusing any of that. I'm just telling you. I'm being honest with you about that. But this young man demonstrates something different. He makes a decision, and he's very persuasive of what he says, and he also has a great deal of confidence when he tells this commander. I want you to see the qualities this young man possesses then. When we think about this, I want you to see these qualities that he possesses, and I want you to see the effect that they have. I want you to see the results that come as a result of these qualities. Go ahead and give me the next one. I want you to see the results of these qualities that happen here. First of all, I want you to see that this young man demonstrates that one person can make a difference. One person can make a difference. Here you've got 40 against one. And this one young man stood up against this whole group of men he knows are coming for Uncle Paul. He goes to the commander that's got to be uncomfortable. And this one man, because he had courage to act, he made a difference. And furthermore, not only that, but God answered his prayer. Now then, I want you to tie this part together. Go back with me to verse 12. And this is repeated two other times. And when it was day, some of the Jews bound together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. But now then, Paul is going to be delivered from prison. He's going to be in prison 5 years, 2 years in Rome. And then he's going to be released. Paul is going to live 10 more years from this point. Do you get the humor in that? These guys have said, we're not going to eat nor drink until he's dead. It's going to be a long fast. He's going to live 10 more years. Who's going to die first? Right? And then those 5 years. While he's in prison in Rome, those 2 years, he writes Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. And before he's dead, he writes 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Here this young man prays that Uncle Paul may be spared, and he acts decisively with courage to stand up because he's persuasive enough and confident enough in what he is doing, and then makes a difference. We may think that, oh, we're just one person. And just one person, nobody's going to notice. Nobody's going to really notice this one person that stands up. Listen, when you've got everybody headed the wrong way and the wrong way's over a cliff and one person stands up to say, whoa, don't go there. There may be somebody else in the crowd that you don't know about that doesn't want to go along with the crowd, but they're going along because they don't have the ability to be decisive and courageous enough to act, but because you have stood up. Now they will stand up with you. In the face of the bully, often the solution to answering the charge of a bully is to stand up to the bully. Again, my great philosopher, Andy Griffith. There's an episode in which Opie has his milk money being stolen by an older boy that is his bully. And Barney kind of repetitiously finds out what this young boy is doing, but he can't do anything about it, so Andy knows what's taking place, and so he takes Opie fishing and tells about how he used to fish that hole, but yeah, there was a boy his age that used to push him off that hole, but Andy said, when I finally stood up to him, said, we're fishing this hole, aren't we? And Opie's sitting there thinking, oh, yeah. And so the next morning, Opie brings some clothes by the jail and says, Paul, would you watch these? You know, Aunt B doesn't like me to get dirty. And then he said, Paul, when you had that tussle, did it hurt? He said, yeah. But we fished at the hole, didn't we? So just a little bit, Opie comes back. His clothes are torn. And he's got a black eye. And now he's got all the money back. And he gives Barney his dime back. And with a black eye, they're going to go next door to get a piece of meat to put it on there to take the swelling and the color out. And Opie says, Paul, do we have to do that? He wants to wear the black eye with courage. The point was, he learned finally to stand up. I know it's hard for young people when they're the only ones standing up to stand up. But we want to raise our young people to be courageous to act. And to be that one person that can make a difference. In this congregation, as a young person, you be that one young person that can make a difference. You be that young person, that one young person that can be a leader. You be that one young person that everybody else looks to with confidence. In this congregation, if you're associated with young people as you're older, you be that one person that these young people know they can come to and they can talk to you. Because you will listen to them and you will help them. I tell you what, in preaching sometimes it's not easy. In being an elder sometimes it's not easy. And sometimes in being an elder in a group of other elders, it's not easy to be the one that stands up. But what this young man did was he demonstrated distinctiveness for us, that with a decisiveness and persuasiveness and confidence, he was the young man that made the difference. I want to suggest to you some areas our young people can make a difference. Our young people can be distinctive, and we need to convince them of that. They can be distinctive with their moral values. Young people, you don't have to follow the crowd. You don't have to follow the crowd. I read the story of one young mother. Actually, she wasn't young. She had teenage children. She had what was called a cookie jar that sat on the table, except it wasn't filled with cookies. She knew her children were going to engage in sex, so she was just going to provide a way for them to protect themselves in doing so. And what she had done was she had therefore set them up to fail and to tell them that sex outside of marriage is all right. Folks, our young people can endure a lot, and our young people can make right decisions. Our young people can be moral. Our young people don't have to be immoral. Young people, you can say no to those things. You can say no to the sexual promiscuity of this world. You can say no to drugs. You can say no to alcohol because you know those things are wrong. You can say no to the way that you talk. You can say no to the language that you know is coarse and the language that you know is filthy and the kind of language that does not bring honor to God. You can stand up. You don't have to use that kind of language. All that's a byproduct of one thing. Doing those oaths is a byproduct of one thing, a choice. We become engaged in those things because we simply have chosen to do so. And we've chosen to do so out of fear and out of pressure of others, because we were not confident enough to be decisive, to be the one person that could stand up and make the difference. We need to instill in our young people that they can be distinctive. And they can be distinctive in the way that they dress. Young men, dress, when we talk about it, it's not just talking about girls. Pay attention, young men, to the t-shirts that you wear and the language on those t-shirts. Pay attention to how you present yourself as a young man. I'm not saying you always have to have your hair combed and you always have to be shaved and all that stuff. I'm not suggesting that. But what I'm saying is, pay attention to how you dress and how you present yourself. And I don't know, because I don't shop for them. But my wife tells me that the clothes for young girls and young women and older women is just almost impossible to buy today. Because in some ways, they're so low, they're revealing. They're so high, they're revealing. They're so tight, they're revealing. And it's hard to find the kind of clothes that a young woman who would want to give a sense of shamefastness to others, to demonstrate a sense of sensitivity and shame and respect for herself, hard to find. But young girls, you don't have to dress like the rest of the world. And most, I know when you have those young girls. I know when you have those young girls. My daughter talks to her mother about this all the time. I know when you have those young girls that your daughter wants to dress like her friends. But when you go to the store and you try to buy those clothes for your daughter, don't give in to your daughter because she wants to dress like her friends. You know what she needs to wear, and you know what needs to be distinctive to therefore present her with a sense of shame and sensitivity. You want her to be presented respectfully. And yes, there's a real draw to fit in both boys and girls in that. But our young people can be distinctive, and they can be the kind of person in their class, in their peers, that can stand out and set the right example, and others may follow. Our young people can be moral people. Our young people can endure a whole lot more than we think they can endure. And our young people can accomplish a whole lot more than we think they can accomplish. But when we tell them, you can't do this, you're going to fail, we're just setting them up for that failure. What we're talking about is setting them up for success. I'm not blind to the temptations that are there. I understand those things. We've addressed those things this week. But we're trying to set our children up for the opportunity to succeed with a sense of self-discipline, self-denial that we've talked about. Because they have an honor that there's no price that's high enough for them to sell their honor. They're going to sell their honor because that's the kind of respect they have for themselves. And then I think it's necessary that we help our young children understand their great value. Their great value. When I talked about the confidence a while ago, this young man, I think it's important that we help our young people understand the great value and help our young people understand that in life not everybody gets a trophy. In our egalitarian world, that means where we try to make everybody equal. We've not encouraged people to succeed. We're encouraging people to fail and give everybody a trophy for failing. That's not the real world. You know if you work in the workplace, not everybody gets a trophy. You know if you coach basketball, not everybody gets a trophy. You know if you've competed, not everybody gets a trophy. But I want you to understand something, young people. Your value is not in how you dress. Your value is not in whether you're recognized and approved of by others. Your value and your worth grow out of someone that is exponentially greater and more significant than anybody you could ever measure yourself by. What makes you valuable and what gives you worth is your relationship with God. Paul said, we are more than conquerors through Him. He did not call us to be losers. He called us to be victors. And He called us to be conquerors. And He's going to give a crown of life to those who are conquerors. Not those who are perfect, not those who are sinless, but those who are distinctive enough to stand up and recognize their true worth and their true value grows out of the fact that they have a relationship with God and they see how much God loved them because He died on a cross for them. When His hands are nailed on that cross, it's not just the ugliness of sin that's there. It's the width and the depth and the height. It's the measure of love that He's calling out to say, I love you and I love you this much. And I have no way to show you how much I can measure that. And I'm reaching out to call you to me. Your worth and your value is not found in the world. Satan will diminish you. Satan will use you. Satan will dispose of you. Satan will therefore cause you to lose. But I'm calling you to victory. I'm calling you to value. Young people, recognize. It's not the latest clothes. It's not the latest shoes. It's not the latest car. It's not the latest gadget that makes you valuable. It's not whether you're the homecoming queen or the homecoming king. Is that you distinctively stand out as a person who has a relationship with God. And because you are distinctive with that and you're courageous enough to stand up, you are persuasive with what you tell people about who you are. God will give you that confidence to be measured by your relationship with Him and therefore be able to stand up and say, do not yield. That's what that young man confidently said. Do not yield. You don't have to give in. Satan is going to tell you, it's okay. You've got those desires. You give in to those desires. Your friends are drinking that bottle. Your friends are popping that pill. They're shooting that needle. Your friends are talking this way on Facebook. Your friends are tweeting this kind of message. They're Instagramming these pictures out here. It's okay to Instagram that picture of yourself where everybody in the world can see that. No. That's what Satan wants you to hear. That's what Satan wants you to do. Satan wants you to demean and diminish yourself and to therefore see yourself of no value just like everybody else has no value. What we've done is we have dumbed down morality. And we've dumbed down our self-worth in doing so. We've dumbed it down to the lowest common denominator. And what we then have done is acted like the ancestors we are purported to have evolved from. If what I have evolved from is a piece of pond scum at the right time rolled down a hill in a pond that was the right degree, and I just happened to at the pond's burp rind up and then be who I am today, where's the value in a person like that? Where's the value in the fact that we are simply glorified apes? Where's the value in that? But when we know we have been created by God, and we are God's special creation having been reborn, and He made us in His image and He sought to remake us in His image by sending His Son as a Redeemer. That makes us somebody. And young people, don't cower. Don't be like Ricky was. Be like Paul's nephew. And what we can do is we can help our young people have the right attitude. We talked last night about four questions from four different people. And yes, I know young people have an attitude sometimes. But let me read you a couple of passages. Turn with me to the book of Philippians chapter 2 real quickly. Philippians chapter 2. I want you to see what the Apostle Paul has to say here in Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Philippians chapter 2, verse 14. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Well, time out. Stop there. Notice he doesn't give an age restriction. He says only 62-year-olds do this. He didn't give an age restriction there. He's talking to the saints at Philippi. So therefore, young person, if you are a Christian, no matter your young age, if you are a Christian, what he says to Christians is you do all things without complaining and disputing. That means because you respect the authority of your parents and you respect yourselves and you have a control of yourself, you're going to do all things without complaining and disputing. There's not going to be any argument about it. You're not going to argue with your parents about that. You're not going to complain because that's not what Christians do. Then he goes on to say that you may become blameless and harmless children of God with a thought without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you shine as lights in the world. How do you shine as a light in the world? By not grumbling and complaining. You don't have to have that attitude. Look at me in Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 22. Last passage, then we'll close. But the fruit of the Spirit is... Now pause. Notice, he doesn't start that by saying, when you're 62, the fruit of the Spirit is. He's talking about those who've been born again. Those who bear the image of the Spirit because they've been born again. He's talking about Christians. And young people, if you're a Christian, what he says is the fruit of the Spirit is what? Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law, and that's what we've been talking about all week. And what that means is that love, joy, peace, long-suffering, self-control means, well, I'm crossing the line here. You don't treat your siblings with hate. You don't treat your siblings as though they have no value. Why? Because you're a Christian. Young people, let me ask you something. When you see older people act like that in the church, what's your reaction? Is your reaction, those are Christians? Well, what's our reaction when we see you who are young do that? Are those Christians? You see, the greatest advertisement the Lord's church has today is not your sign on the road. It's not your website. It's a changed life. It's a life that's been transformed because you have given your heart and your will to the Lord, and He's transformed you to look like Him, to be in His image, and you therefore bear the fruit of the Spirit. The greatest advertisement you could have is to be transformed in the image of Christ and think like He thinks, care like He cares, love like He loves, and have His disposition. You don't have to have that attitude. And parents, we don't have to let them. And parents, if our children are Christians in a young age, and they're having that sour disposition with their siblings or with you, then if God's book is good enough for you, isn't God's book good enough for them to open and to read? Because this isn't Ricky talking. This is what the Holy Spirit said. This is what the Holy Spirit said. This young man, Paul's nephew, helps us understand what it is to be distinctive. Young people, you can do it. I know you can do it. At home, from high school down to our youngest age group, we have 175. That doesn't include the babies that aren't in class yet. And yeah, we have young people that have problems. But we also have some awesome and distinctive young people. And I think you have those here. Don't you, Tim? I think you have some of those young people here. And I want to encourage you to keep doing it and keep growing. The story is told of an 8th grade young girl. A counselor came in to the classroom and was trying to persuade the children to, as they stand up for themselves, to actually be disrespectful for their parents. And the counselor said, "What if your parents told you to go do your laundry?" And what the counselor wanted the children to answer was to tell their parents, "No, I'm not going to do it." Well, there was one young lady who responded to the counselor. The counselor said, "What if your parents told you to do your laundry?" The young lady said, "I would do my laundry." The counselor said, "You would go do your laundry? Well, what if your parents asked you to do something wrong? Would you do that?" The young lady responded, "My parents won't ask me to do something wrong." Well, she might not have made a good grade in class, but she sure was distinctive. And she sure stood up because she was courageous enough to act. Me, you. Let's have that distinctiveness that makes us like Christ. If we can help you this evening in some way, be right with God. Won't you come while we stand and while we sing?